And good morning. It is time to get up with baseball. A last-ditch effort to save a shortened season. Is this the last chance for the sport this summer? Plus, we are 100 days to the start of the NFL season. And I've got all the picks, including MVP, Super Bowl champ, and the one team that could go 16-0. Plus, did you know one of the five best quarterbacks in the NFL isn't in the NFL? Our general manager has a scouting report you need to hear as we get up with you starting right now. And a good morning to all of you watching Korea Baseball. I am Mike Greenberg. We are in Bristol this morning, and this is Get Up. We have a very busy day filled with a lot of news from around the world of sports to bring you here. You've been watching baseball from the other side of the world. Let's bring you some a little closer to home. Major League Baseball has discussed the possibility of shortening this season to around 50 games and paying players their full prorated salaries. However, sources say the league views this plan as a last resort and does not intend to propose it to the players. We need to understand then what it all means. And here we have the people to help us with that. Jeff Passan, our insider, and our buddy Doug Glanville is with us. Jeff, I'll start with you. What is the league trying to do by bringing up this 50 game season?
I think the league, Greeny, is trying to force the players to come somewhere into the middle. Because let's remember, the original proposal from Major League Baseball was for 82 games and a huge salary cut that was significant, particularly at the top end. The players came back with a 114-game schedule and no pay cuts, full pro rata. Both of those propositions were on, like, polar opposite ends, and frankly, neither was particularly realistic. And so what MLB's trying to do here by talking about the 50-game season is to push the parties somewhere into the middle. That's the hopes of this, but Rob Manfred does believe that he has the right, because of a March 26th agreement, to unilaterally impose a schedule of his desirous length, and 50 games would really go far for the owners who want to play fewer games.
So if I'm a baseball fan, I'm sitting here, I'm listening, and I'm just wondering, what does it all mean, Jeff? What does, put this into English that a baseball fan can understand. Let's take the negotiating language out of it. What does it mean? Are we working towards something getting resolved, and how quickly?
Major League Baseball wants to play baseball this year. The players want to play baseball this year. They need to stop both being stubborn and giving up the summer months and all of the advantage that they have, and come somewhere in the middle and find an agreement. That's essentially what this is, Greeny. That's the purpose of this. This 50-game schedule is a cudgel that is being used to push the players off of their position. And look, the players have been stubborn. The owners have been stubborn. Everybody's been stubborn here. So this is the thing, I think, that ultimately will get them moving. Now, will it get them moving in the right direction? That is what remains to be seen.
Doug Glanville, let me bring you in here. Obviously, as a longtime player yourself, you understand how tight-knit that union is. And so you probably have a good sense of what conversations are going on there. What would you like to see? If someone called you up and said, Doug, you're now the commissioner of the world, and you could just sort of make this thing work the way you think it works best, how would you do it?
Yeah, well, I mean, think about the player perspective on this for a second. When you consider that being in the middle, you know, if you have this half season, right, 82 games roughly, you know, that's progress off of 50, clearly. And the idea is more focused on the structure of it, right? So if you're getting, because before we got to this point where it's prorated based on your salary, you were at a place where you were getting 30 cents on the dollar, 70. So now if you're getting something that's related exactly to your salary on a game basis, that's a structure you can build on, because you have to look at the bigger win down the road once you get past 2020 and look towards 21. And they both need to kind of get in that vision that they'll have another opportunity to get at this next season, next year. It's really important for multiple reasons why they need to get on the field now. So big picture, looking beyond the sport in a sort of societal level, and then just like crunch the numbers. But the players have that part where they're getting prorated salaries. That's a huge victory structurally wise. Number of games to be determined, but I don't think that's as material as the structure.
Okay, and here's what I want to do. I want to stop talking about the money for a minute, because I think the baseball fans don't want to hear that. Doug, let me ask you this. How many games do they have to play in your mind as a player for this to be a season of substance, of consequence? Because like someone asked me the question this morning, and I don't know the answer. If they play a 50-game season and someone hits 400, does it count? Is he now the first person to hit 400 since Ted Williams did it? I don't know how to answer that question. How many games do they have to play, Doug Glanville, for it to be a season that should be recognized and taken seriously?
I mean, and this is unprecedented time, so it doesn't matter. As many as you can play, that's what they're going to negotiate for. And you hit 400, you hit 400. I mean, you could put the asterisk next to it, but that's history. And there was a strike season, 1981, split season. You know, these are the circumstances by which you're under. And so, of course, we recognize that there could be some rookie hit 30 home runs in a 50-game schedule, and this guy's going to be Babe Ruth for a season. So if you live to fight another day in 2021, then we'll see what happens on a full season.
Just for fun, I'm going to ask you that question, Jeff Passan, because it seems more fun than talking about these people trying to figure out how to divide up all of their money. Fast forward this to the end of a 50-game season, and you are on this show, and we are having this conversation about whether someone hitting 400 in a 50-game season should be placed alongside Ted Williams and all the other. Which side of that argument will you fall on?
I will fall on the no. It's a 50-game season. It doesn't count. And here's why, Greeny. Let's look back at the first 50 games of last season. Do you remember what the Washington Nationals, who, by the way, ended up being world champions, record was after 50 games last year? It was 19-31. The Nationals would not have been anywhere close to the playoffs. And in baseball, the idea is, you know, the season tends to stabilize right around the halfway mark, like halfway of a full 162 games. That's when we get a sense of what teams are, who they are, who players are in a particular year. Now, someone can hit 400, and it would be awesome, and it would be great to see, but it would not be Ted Williams.
Did you see that note, by the way, from Hembo popped up there? Like clockwork, once every 140 years, they play one of these very short seasons in Major League Baseball. Let's see where it winds up. Yeah. Anyway, I just find this more fun than talking about the money. Jeff, stay on this for us, and we will continue to follow it, obviously, as we go. Meanwhile, to change the topic completely, well, things that are going on around us in the world and the connection they have to the world of sports. The death of George Floyd has sparked reaction all across our world of sports, including from boxer Floyd Mayweather, who has offered to pay for the funeral service, an offer that's been accepted by the family. The National Basketball Coaches Association has announced it's established a committee on racial justice and reform. Greg Popovich and Steve Kerr are among the coaches on the committee. So is Monty Williams. He will join us live a little later this morning. And add Trae Young to the list of NBA players speaking at protests around the nation. Here is part of what Young had to say in a protest in his hometown of Norman, Oklahoma.
I know this country is in a messed up place right now. And for me, I just think it's important that we all stick together and we stand up for what's right. And it's not just going to take just me. It's not just going to take just you. It's all of us coming together and doing this as a collective unit. And I feel like justice will be served and changes will be made if we all come together. And this is us doing it. This is the first step.
Tiger Woods also releasing a statement on Twitter last night, and here's what he wrote. My heart goes out to George Floyd, his loved ones, and all of us who are hurting right now. I've always had the utmost respect for our law enforcement. They train so diligently to understand how, when, and where to use force. This shocking tragedy clearly crossed that line. I remember the L.A. riots and learned that education is the best path forward. We can make our points without burning the very neighborhoods that we live in. I hope that through constructive, honest conversations, we can build a safer, unified society. And so I have Doug Glanville with me still this morning, and Ryan Clark joins us here as well. RC, good morning. And I want to start with you, Ryan, if I can. You and I have been having these conversations, it feels like now, for a very long time. I remember a day 4 years ago when you came on my old show, Mike and Mike, and you were wearing a Colin Kaepernick jersey. And I remember a lot of the reaction that ensued from that you had to hear and we did and everything else. And here we are 4 years later. It all feels very different now. And I wonder what your thoughts are in that context.
You know, I think the conversations have been different this time. I know for sure my phone has rang and my text messages have beeped with non-blacks reaching out to me to let me know that they're listening, to let me know that they're a part of trying to find a solution or at least a part of caring. It definitely makes me wonder why. You know, why now? Eric Garner, he couldn't breathe either. You know, Breonna Taylor, she wasn't even in a position to defend herself in her own home. And so whereas you are, I guess, excited or at least sort of starting to feel a little comfort in the fact that other people are listening, I think it's still extremely, extremely difficult. I'm no longer angry. I'm no longer mad. I'm just disappointed. I'm sad. It's heavy. And so now I think it's about trying to find a solution moving forward, about people actually listening and putting those things that they learn into action. You know, I grew up in New Orleans. I grew up in the South. I was a 19-year-old black kid who had a child with a white woman, you know, and that family seemed to love me. They loved the fact that I played ball and I was extremely intelligent. But I remember the first conversation once we found out we were having this child. I was no longer this great athlete. I was no longer this straight A student. I was the N-word from down the street who played football, who wouldn't take care of his child. And I remember 2 years later going to pick up Jaden from her grandparents' house and her grandfather running after me to apologize to me because he didn't know. And if he never, and he passed shortly after, but if he never had that experience with me, to him, black people were never good enough to be a part of their family. See, I was good enough to live down the street and I was good enough to watch play ball, but I wasn't good enough to be a part of their family. And now I'm moving on and raising this child in the house with my African-American wife, my other two children. They're all the same to me. I treat them all the exact same way. My daughter being half of something that I'm not doesn't keep me from loving her, you know, and that's what we want from America, right? The fact that we're different shouldn't keep you from loving us. And that's kind of what we've seen. And I don't know if it's because the act was just so nonchalant, so heinous, so uncaring, because there was no part of that man, of Officer Chauvin, that seemed slightly sympathetic, empathetic, that even cared about the person he was kneeling on and taking his breath. Maybe that's why people spoke up, or maybe because Carson Wentz and Zach Ertz said something. Now white people feel it's okay to reach out. And it's hard to raise a child and to have my son, when he gets his license, he ran a stop sign. They said he rolled through, and I didn't necessarily punish him or get mad at him. I was like, you got to drive better. Then he got pulled over for speeding. And I remember my wife being so mad at me, like, Ryan, you got to do more. You need to punish him. You need to get on him. You need to do this. And I was like, well, why, babe? He's just driving. But she said, because every time they pull him over, that's another opportunity they get to shoot him. And you know, if they shoot him, nobody will fix it. And he'll never be back. And that's every single day. And whereas I am excited that people actually care this time, I hate that we're tearing down our own communities. I hate that we're tearing down our own stuff. I hate that we are not working to build instead of destroy, but at least they're listening. And I also wonder, we have all this systematic outrage, this institutional outrage, which it's not run by us, right? Like when I got an opportunity to talk this morning, I was told, don't say this, or you can't say that, or it's cool to be in this place, but you can't be here, because we don't make no rules. We don't make the rules. And so when you don't make the rules, you can't make the change. And so we're talking about everybody's, what can we do? What can we do? You got to vote. You got to be different. You got to act different. You got to treat people different. You got to love differently. You got to teach differently. And when people are mad to have AR-15s at the Capitol in Michigan because they can't go to salons and because they can't go to beaches and because they can't do these things that they feel like they are entitled to freaking do, but there's no outrage. Because we tear down the Confederate past in Charlottesville, Virginia, and there's outrage and there's mad, but where's the systematic outrage? Where's the institutional? Where the rubber freaking bullets? They ain't there. And so if we want to change stuff, we got to change how we deal with it. You can't tell us how to grieve. You can't tell us that you can be this mad, but you can't be that mad, because you ain't dying. And so when I do feel better that people are listening, it still ain't better for us. And when you hear, if you don't like it, go back to your country. This is my freaking country. I was born in Algiers, New Orleans, Louisiana, the USA. And it's not that we don't love it here. I love a lot of things that I could like better if they were different. And so I am encouraged that people are listening. I am. I do feel like there's some validation in many things that I've said. that I felt, that I've protested against. Many times I've reached out in the community to try to make change. I just hope that now, moving forward, the next thing isn't black people shouldn't do this. Why are you so angry? Hopefully now, since they are listening, since you tell me you're listening, you've listened enough to know why we're so pissed off.
Brian, thank you for that. Doug, you sent some notes, and I saw in them that you sent a quote from Nelson Mandela that I will read here. Mandela said, "Sport has the power to change the world. It has the power to inspire. It has the power to unite people in a way that little else does." Why were you thinking about that, and what are your thoughts today?
Well, I thought about the fact that Nelson Mandela set the tone under a system of apartheid. And still remain positive, still found a way to work within a system and to create a system to try to bring people together. And sport became central to that mission. So when you think about experience, my story, as Ryan's is, I was exposed to police early in my life. My father was a psychiatrist, and part of his practice was working with law enforcement. So I understood early on the stresses and struggles they went through. And within that, there was a time where my summer league baseball team was coached by a volunteer police officer from my hometown. And those players on that team, including the son of that officer, became officers in their own right, and some of which have retired recently. And so exposure and intimacy matters, because to speak to Ryan, when you don't have an opportunity to share space with each other, you don't have this chance to really see people in this humanizing way, then of course you're going to rely on your biases because you're living in this segregated world. You don't have that access. And sports has a tendency to break some of that down, just like in baseball with spring training, there's people from all over the world coming together. And so when you have an exposure where you're not just dealing with policing in an occupied force, which is unfortunately a lot of our cities in America, but you see it in a chance that you're working towards a common goal and you understand that we're all experiencing things in this sort of common area, that does make a difference. And so when my father treated these officers and all the stresses they were experiencing, eventually in 2002, the last game of the season, my father passed away. And so we had the funeral in my hometown of Teaneck. And my colleagues, my former teammates, all showed up in full police attire to pay their respects. And in that room were members of the Philadelphia Phillies, the front office. It was a kaleidoscope of people. But most importantly, we were together as one family. And they gave my father a police escort to the burial site to sort of bring us all into this one space out of respect. And so I have a privilege of being able to see the potential of how we can be together and work together and we can humanize each other. Because when you see someone as a human, as an equal, you're not going to sit on his neck and choke him out till he's gone. You're going to have that pause to say, wait a minute, this is a father, a brother. This is American. We would connect the dots better. And sports could have a role in that. And it certainly had a role in my life. So we have a lot of work to do because, you know, as Ryan said, we've watched scenarios where a black person doing something mundane not only is met with deadly force, but the fact that people are willing to call the police just because you're suspicious. And when you walk around in the world where you're always fitting the description, you're always fitting some description, whether it's on a police blotter from a crime in the next neighboring town, or whether it's in the imagination of what society has reinforced about who we are and why we're constantly a threat. And so you're not going to just fix it by having kumbaya and having, you know, flag waving tournaments. And we're going to have to figure out how to get at those institutions that reinforce those attitudes. And by the way, when people have the privilege of having a 90-yard head start, you can't say starting today, we're going to have a neutral policy and we're going to go from zero because someone has already had this huge advantage. And so you have to unpack a lot of things and then rebuild things. But as Ryan said, you have to do it together because you're not going to fix law enforcement and address it without bringing law enforcement to the table. And therefore, you have to understand each other. Connecticut is a good example because their police council that sets policy, that trains officers, that have academies, it is a civilian, also included organization. They do work with law enforcement and civilians, and you have to listen when people are talking. So hopefully more people are listening, but I am afraid that once we get on the other side and maybe this officer is, you know, arrested again, you know, put under the jail, whatever happens to him, that we don't go back to saying, hey, you know what? You know, it's all done. We're post-racial. Punishment fit the crime. And now we fixed it. It's going to take a lot more than that. And only time will tell.
These conversations are very important, and I'm glad that we can have them. I also know that these feelings are very personal. I thank you both for being willing to share them here. I will take a short time out. We'll come back. We have a good deal of sports on the program to get to this morning, including today is 100 days until the opening kickoff in the NFL. We'll talk about these two legends and which one has a huge edge. That's next. Get Up on ESPN.
Though we're apart these days, we're sharing more. So at GEICO, we'd like to say thanks. Thanks for sharing your savage dance moves. Thanks for sharing your DIY haircut fails. Thanks for sharing your inner lip sync star. Now it's our turn to share with the GEICO Give Back, a 15% credit on car and motorcycle policies for current and new customers. Because we're committed for the long haul, the 15% credit lasts your full policy term. Visit geico.com/giveback for more info and eligibility.
It could be a routine drive to pick up the kids after school or an epic road trip across the country. No matter where your travels take you, we know those miles count. We're Marathon. We have over 5,700 stations across our great nation. Our people are working hard every day to provide you with quality top-tier gasoline to improve engine performance and fuel your life. Marathon, fueling the American spirit.
Get Up is brought to you by Corona Extra. Find your beach. Well, guess what? We are 100 days until the start of the NFL season, and there is obviously a lot to watch for. One of the big stories involves Tom Brady, who left New England after 20 seasons. His Bucs will face Drew Brees and the Saints in a very interesting week one matchup. The NFC East, meanwhile, will look a lot different. The Eagles won it last year at 9-7. The Cowboys, the Skins, and the Giants have all made changes at head coach. Last year's MVP, Lamar Jackson, will go for an encore in his third season. He's 23 years old. He led the league in touchdown passes and set a single-season rushing record for a quarterback as well. And the reigning Super Bowl champion Kansas City Chiefs look to be the first back-to-back champs in 15 years. They open up on Thursday night in week one against the Texans. And Ryan Clark continues with us this morning. And we are joined by Mike Tannenbaum and Dan Graziano. I want to take a look at one of the storylines that each of you may find to be the most interesting and important. And RC, I will start with you. What is the one thing you will have your eye on most closely when they start this thing in 100 days?
Is the new stamp of the new head coaches in the NFL and their teams. If you look at Matt Rule, Joe Judge, Kevin Stefanski, these are guys taking over organizations, taking over teams who want to make vast improvements, but they didn't get an offseason. They don't have an opportunity to stamp this team with the type of personality or the type of characteristics that will be typical of their coaching. And so what do they look out right out of the gate when the season starts? Can the Cleveland Browns get all of this talent together and improve? What type of quarterback is Daniel Jones? And does this offense move forward? And also in Carolina, now you have Teddy Bridgewater, you have a young Joe Brady as an offensive coordinator. You just signed CMC. Can these new head coaches who have never been in this position in an unprecedented time get their teams to play high quality football from the start of the regular season?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point here that I wonder if people are thinking enough about based on the uncertainty of the circumstance. And Mike Tannenbaum, I know yours is somewhat similar but goes to a very specific place.
That's exactly right. Continuity matters, Greeny. Let's go to opening day. Drew Brees, Tom Brady, we're all excited to see these two icons play each other. But Drew Brees and Sean Payton have been together for 215 games. Ironically, second only to Tom Brady and Bill Belichick. On the other side, Tom Brady and Bruce Arians, game number one. And in this weird offseason where they haven't been together, that's a huge advantage for the Saints. So I think this Buccaneer offense is going to be a big work in progress. And while watching Brees and Brady will be great, Drew Brees has a 215-game lead in terms of continuity and experience over Tom Brady on opening day.
Well, so it's an interesting point. So, Dan Graziano, before we move away from that, I want to live in this conversation for just a moment. What are you hearing from these teams that have new head coaches and are trying to install whatever it is they're trying to install under these circumstances on Zoom and whatever else they're using? What are you hearing about how those things are going?
Well, they're going as well as they can. I think the reception from players on these teams has been good in terms of the virtual offseason, in terms of attendance and attentiveness. I think when you talk to coaches, they say it's going as well as it can. It, you know, you would expect it to be difficult and challenging in its own way, but they are eager to get guys on the field. And obviously everybody recognizes that a lot of things have to happen, a lot of questions have to be answered before you can get players on the field. But especially the new coaches, very eager to find out what the procedures are going to be in terms of training camp, when they'll be able to start training camps, and when they can actually get guys on a practice field and start putting some of this stuff into practice. Because there's no question that the new coaches especially are well behind where they should be at this point in terms of preparation due to circumstances that obviously no one could control.
So, RC, would it be your, if we're going to sort of make a projection here, would it be your expectation that those teams will struggle early in the season, that the teams with new coaches and even a place like Tampa where Arians is not a new coach but they have a new quarterback, do you believe they'll struggle?
You know, I don't necessarily know if you can bring it to Tampa. Tampa might not be flying at the clip they're expected to by the end of the season early on. But I do think you can even go to Ron Rivera. You can even go to Mike McCarthy in Washington and in Dallas and look at some of these teams and say it may be a little difficult to make the type of jump or the type of changes you need to make as new head coaches. So I expect teams that don't have that type of continuity, don't have that type of chemistry yet, to have a difficult time getting out the gate as fast as these teams who have experience to draw upon as the season starts.
In the meantime, Dan Graziano, let me come to you because a lot has to happen in the next 99 days for the season to actually start in 100. So what are the things that we should be keeping an eye on if we are to hope that we will have football 100 days from today?
Yeah, look, just start with training camp. Are they going to be able to have it? And if so, when would it start? What would the procedures be in terms of trying to keep everyone safe? That's going to be the first real testing ground. If we assume that players are going to be back in buildings and practicing, then that's going to be the first real chance for the league to put into practice whatever protocols it has to put into in terms of testing, in terms of keeping players safe. And then you look ahead to the season. Players are having a lot of questions right now. There are regular conference calls with the players and the Players Association where players are asking questions about their own personal safety, about how things are going to work in terms of testing. What happens if someone's infected? What happens if someone isn't comfortable playing because maybe they have a pre-existing condition and they don't want to expose themselves and then maybe their families to the virus. So there are a lot of things that have to be answered in those next 99 days before we even know what it's going to look like in terms of players putting on uniforms, putting on helmets, and actually playing this game.
All right, we will keep an eye on all of that a little later in this morning. I will make a series of predictions, all of which are guaranteed to come true, and we'll see what these guys think of them as we go along. In the meantime, as we continue here, you're not going to hear too many arguments that Patrick Mahomes is the best quarterback in football. But what if our general manager told you the second best may not even be in the NFL? You'll hear that on the way. It's Get Up on ESPN.
Geico gets you access to licensed agents 24/7, which means that Geico is always there for you. If only everyone was always there for you. Like your mom, when you fill out really, really important paperwork on the first day of a new job.
Name, check. Birthday, Social Security, is that a thing? Hey, Mom, what is my Social Security number? Mom? 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 Okay, let's guess. 0017. Oh, Gemini. Hashtag done.
Geico. Always there for you with savings and 24/7 access to licensed agents.
We're back on Get Up, and reaction has poured in around the world of sports to the death of George Floyd. We've seen players taking part in protests around the country. Clemson head coach Dabo Swinney, meanwhile, talked with the media yesterday about his reaction.
I know that we are all hurting for the Floyd family and our country. You know, I can speak for our entire staff and our team in that regard for sure. We have all witnessed just disgusting acts of evil. That's really the only word I can appropriately use over the past, recent week here and just and beyond. And there's no question that these are challenging times. But what I've learned is where there is no challenge, there is no change. And we have to all accept the challenge and all help to bring about positive change and growth.
Now, the man you saw standing next to Dabo there, of course, is his quarterback, Trevor Lawrence, and he himself has weighed in on Twitter. He tweeted, "There has to be a shift in the way of thinking. Rational must outweigh irrational. Justice must outweigh injustice. Love must outweigh hate. If you put yourself in someone else's shoes and you don't like how it feels, that's when you know things need to change. I'm siding with my brothers that deal and continuously deal with things I will never experience. The injustice is clear and so is the hate. It can no longer be explained away. If you're still explaining it, check your heart and ask why." Again, those are the words of Trevor Lawrence, showing exemplary leadership off the field to align with what we have regularly seen from his leadership on the field. Trevor Lawrence is one of the most anticipated prospects in a very long time. For that part of the story, here's Laura Rutledge.
I wanted to have a big impact as a freshman.
Lawrence with the run coming, finds T. Higgins, touchdown!
I think when it was all said and done, Trevor Lawrence would be the first overall pick.
If the rules were different, Trevor Lawrence might already be in the NFL, with certainty surrounding his upcoming season. Instead, he has another chance to prove it wasn't just one exceptional game.
The Tigers reclaim their crown by crushing Alabama.
Oh, that game. A slaughtering of Alabama to win it all, and the time Trevor Lawrence beat two top five opponents by at least 25 points in the span of 11 days. He was on fire.
Trevor Lawrence is a freak.
His sophomore season was different mostly because Lawrence was tasked with chasing his own greatness. His interception total doubled. His completion percentage, just 51% against top teams Ohio State and LSU. He had a career-high 10 off-target throws against the Purple and Gold Tigers in the national championship.
You know, they beat us tonight. There's no excuses.
Trevor Lawrence was human at times in 2019.
It's going to be picked off as he makes a mistake.
So unlike Trevor Lawrence.
And also inhuman.
Lawrence took a big downfield, breaks a tackle, and is still running.
In 2020, Lawrence has a chance to prove once and for all he's at the top of the game and the top of the draft.
So one of the most interesting storylines here with Mr. T and Ryan Clark back with us. And I, Mike Tannenbaum, I want to start with you as an evaluator. If you were starting a franchise right now and you could draft amongst all of the quarterbacks that exist, the college, and literally putting everyone into the conversation, taking into account their age and everything else, where would Trevor Lawrence wind up going?
Greedy, he'd be number two for me. It's Patrick Mahomes, draw a line. It's Trevor Lawrence. And maybe in that conversation, you would have Russell Wilson, Deshaun Watson. Aaron Rodgers, because of age, is probably out. Lamar Jackson's below that. There's other players I like a lot, like Carson Wentz, but durability becomes a factor. This guy checks all the boxes. And, oh, by the way, he won't be 21 until October. He has all the physical attributes. You touched on his leadership already. This is a transformational talent who's lost one game in college. And by the way, the game he lost against LSU, he threw for 394 yards.
So, RC, I want to turn to you because I think Laura did a good job of painting it this way. Like, the expectations for Lawrence were off the charts, right? He had to be perfect. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we'd think his season was a disappointment. So maybe it's unfair for me to say my perception of his season last year was that it wasn't spectacular. They didn't play great competition. His numbers weren't quite as good as we were expecting them to be. And in the biggest games, I didn't think he played that well. You watch these games more closely than I do, RC. Is that a reasonable assessment of the season he just had?
Listen, I mean, you know, I've said a lot of people the night after or the morning after the national championship by saying I just didn't see it. Now, I can say this. I got to meet Trevor Lawrence before he got to Clemson, before his senior year. I was working at a camp and I was coaching 7-on-7 defenses. Justin Fields was my quarterback. And I watched Trevor Lawrence play. He has it all. He's tall. He has a cannon. He understands the game. But being on the sideline against LSU in the national championship, he was off and he wasn't good. And you can speak about 394 passing yards, but I'm talking about the errant throws. I'm speaking of having T. Higgins, who was an early second round pick, and Justin Ross on the other side with Travis Etienne, and not being able to move the ball, and it largely being Trevor Lawrence's fault. And so do I think that he has every measurable that you need? Do I think that he's going to be an excellent professional football quarterback? I do. But right now, looking at Trevor Lawrence, even though he has a transcendent talent level, I have not seen a transcendent football player. You go early last season, he struggled. Then he hit a stretch against ACC talent that we barely even got to watch. Not only watched because of this job. And we saw him struggle against Ohio State, which is when I gained a lot of respect for him, because he found other ways to get a win. But in the biggest moments, in the best of times when they needed him last year, I don't think he was great. And that is important to remember, because the two times we needed DeSean Jackson as a Clemson Tiger, he showed up against Alabama and he was spectacular. He was the best player on the field. I haven't seen that from Trevor Lawrence.
And again, it's in being fair to him in every conceivable way. He's going into his junior year, as you just said, Mike Tannenbaum. He's young. We're not trying to knock him here, but people do. And Mike, you're doing it. And Mel has done it as well. Talked about like the best prospects he's ever seen. Andrew Luck, John Elway. You're putting him, Mike Tannenbaum, on that class and that category as a prospect.
Yeah, and not only that, he's clearly better than the last three first overall picks, Kyler Murray, Baker Mayfield, and I would still take him over Joe Burrow in deference, I know, to RC's LSU Tigers because, again, of the size.
That's all good.
And he's done it over 2 years. You know, we could knock him for that one bad game, which, again, he was off, admittedly so, but he has 66 touchdowns in 2 years, and he's still 20 years old. He checks all the boxes, and the reason I would take him over Burrow is, if Burrow was great, Urban Meyer knows what he's doing. Urban Meyer would have played him at Ohio State, and Burrow, let's face it, averaged his first year at LSU. So I'm taking nothing away from Joe Burrow. He was historic last year. But to me, yeah. Greatness, as Mel Kiper, as you alluded to, Greeny, Elway, Luck, I put Trevor Lawrence in that category because he's always been great. Joe Burrow's shown flashes of greatness. That's why I put Lawrence at a category above
him. Hey, Greeny.
Yeah, go ahead, RC.
You know, Greeny, and you know, you look at that, like, I actually don't disagree with the fact that he would be taken above Joe Burrow. I believe if Tua Tagovailoa was healthy, that he would still be taken over him. I mean, I walked past him, and I've already seen him before and been around him and talked to him. I think he's an excellent young man. I walked past him on the field at the national championship, and the first thing I thought to myself was, man, that's what it's supposed to look like. Mm. And honestly, not many look like that. And then you watch the ball come out of his hands. And so I'm not saying that he doesn't have all of the tools and have all of these things. But when we look at him against Ohio State and against LSU, he wasn't the best player on the field. Many points of both of those games, he wasn't the best quarterback on the field. And I know projections aren't about one or two games. And I know you have to look at the whole. And looking at the whole, I think every first round pick that was a quarterback this year, those teams would take Trevor Lawrence right now over Jordan Love, over Tua Tagovailoa, over Justin Herbert, over Joe Burrow. I understand those things. But when you cut the film on against elite talent, which he will see every week in the NFL, Trevor Lawrence has not stood out to me. And when you talk about these transcendent talents, these guys we rank at the top of the game, and again, we're throwing Patrick Mahomes' name out there like this dude is just hot trash. Patrick Mahomes has now set the bar for who is the best quarterback we've ever seen throw a football. So when you put Trevor Lawrence there, I need to see something different in Clemson against the elite talent.
One other thing I wanted to bring up here, just for the moment that we have, guys, is the idea of tanking. Is this a quarterback that people are going to tank for? And whether that really does exist in the NFL. Mike Tannenbaum, there was a perception here on this program. We talked about it at length. Several of us have apologized because it clearly felt like the Dolphins were tanking last year. And then they wound up playing hard. If they were tanking, no one told the coach and no one told the players. And they wound up winning a bunch of games and should have won at least one more that was taken away from them on a terrible call against the Jets. What does that look like? And do you believe people are suggesting that maybe Jacksonville is tanking this year for Trevor? Does that really exist, do you believe, in the NFL?
Yeah, I think there's two aspects to what we're discussing. Strategically, a front office could certainly try to create cap space, acquire draft capital for a certain year. That's what Miami did, and they were able to get their quarterback. Clearly, on paper, Jacksonville looks like that team where they could try to clear some cap space and be ready to move up if they had to for the first pick overall. However, Doug Marrone is a really good head coach. He was a head coach at Syracuse, been a good head coach at Jacksonville. He's going to try to win as many games as possible to keep his job. So I think we're looking at this story of tanking from two different aspects, and we're going to see what happens on the field. That's what's so great about our sport is the narrative will change. Certainly on paper, it could be Jacksonville, but don't underestimate Doug Marrone's coaching ability.
Yeah, just have a few seconds, RC. What are your thoughts?
Listen, man, I ain't never losing. I don't care who it is. I'm not making that choice. But when you look at these teams, you can't get players. They're independent contractors. They're going to go out and work as hard as they possibly can to win. And so are coaches. And so I don't believe necessarily in tanking, but I do believe teams get caught in cap situations. Teams have players they have to get rid of, and they're put in positions where they have this opportunity. I don't think they do it purposely.
All right, we will have more on this as we continue. We'll start a new hour coming up in just a moment. Just when we thought this guy's season was over, think again. Woj and Jalen live in a moment with a wrinkle in the NBA's plan to return. That's next. Get up on ESPN.
Foot odor throwing you off your game? Stick to a winning game plan with Odor Eaters featuring three advanced odor and wetness fighters. The lineup provides long-lasting odor control plus more to keep your feet on their game.
Odor Eaters powder provides outstanding moisture control. Clear drying spray is the MVP in preventing athlete's foot, while insoles work continuously to manage wetness while adding a layer of comfort. Pick up today at Walmart, Target, CVS, Dollar General, or other fine retailers.
Odor Eaters. Destroy foot odor with the best in odor defense.
We have a full day of sports conversation and coverage for you here on ESPN. Coming up, First Take will follow us here on ESPN, followed by SportsCenter, NFL Live, and The Jump. At 4 o'clock, it's 20 minutes of Jalen and Jacoby, highly questionable, and Around the Horn. Then a two-hour SportsCenter at 5 Eastern. The PTI guys will be there at 5:30 and cap your day with SportsCenter with Scott Van Pelt. A complete day of sports conversation here on ESPN. I am Mike Greenberg in Bristol. This is Get Up. We are delighted you've gotten up with us on what is a busy day. And let me start by giving you some information here about the reaction that pours in around the world of sports to the death of George Floyd. We have seen players taking part in protests around the country. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, one of the legendary figures in the history of American sports, wrote an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times on Sunday that read, in part, "I don't want to see stores looted or even buildings burn, but African Americans have been living in a burning building for many years, choking on the smoke as the flames burn closer and closer. Racism in America is like dust in the air. It seems invisible, even if you're choking on it, until you let the sun in. Then you see it's everywhere. As long as we keep shining that light, we have a chance of cleaning it wherever it lands. But we have to stay vigilant because it's always still in the air." Kareem Abdul-Jabbar was on with Scott Van Pelt last night.
Well, I think this is a moment that everybody can point to that an awakening took place. I hope people are now awake to how horrible institutionalized racism is, and that it is a problem that needs to be fixed now, somehow. And we have to start talking about it now. This is urgent. This is not something that we can keep putting off.
We'll be talking about it with Monty Williams in a half hour, the coach of the Suns who wrote a letter to the nation sharing his thoughts. He'll join us to talk about the basketball community's role in affecting positive change. That's 30 minutes from now, right here on ESPN. Meanwhile, let me get up and go with you around the world of sports. It's brought to you by Claritin, and it begins with this. Players from around the MLS skipped workouts yesterday as return-to-play discussions have hit a major impasse. In turn, MLS extended their deadline to tomorrow for the Players Association to either accept an offer on economic concessions for 2020 and a revised CBA or to be locked out. Meanwhile, college football, the Notre Dame Navy game scheduled to be played in Ireland has been moved to Annapolis due to the coronavirus. That game was scheduled to be played on August 29th. Now it will likely be played on Labor Day weekend. Elsewhere, several NBA owners led by the Thunder's Clay Bennett have reportedly asked the league to consider ways to include all 30 teams in a restarted season. However, the league does appear to be moving forward with a 22-team plan. Let's get a closer look at that with our Adrian Wojnarowski and Jalen Rose with us this morning here, and we'll talk about a bunch of stuff. And Woj, let's start with that. You've been saying all along that all 30 teams are not going to come back, but what are some of the concerns of particularly the small market owners who it does not appear will get the chance to come back?
You know, Greeny, I think the short-term concerns are for many
as the league returns to Orlando, there are teams who want to feel a part of the National Basketball Association. They don't want to be left out in the short term. They want to go play. The longer term, the idea of your season ending in March and not starting again, playing another NBA game until likely late December, that big of a gap really worries organizations, especially those rebuilding with young players who they can't have around their facilities. They can't have their hands touching these young players. And financially, you know, in some of these marketplaces, like in Atlanta or in Detroit, where you want to stay in the consciousness of your market, you got to be able to sell tickets. You've got to be able to sell sponsorships. You know, I think there's business and basketball concerns about disappearing for this long.
And that's understandable. We should not, none of us should pretend the business side of this isn't going to be first and foremost in people's minds. Jane, let me ask you as a player, if you were on one of those teams, if you were Steph Curry, for example, he's the perfect example because he's a superstar and he's on a team that is hopelessly out of it. Would you want to come back and play?
So I want to do a distinction, and it all is about time. So if the goal is to complete the regular season as much as possible, now remember, players and obviously teams have taken a pay cut so far already. But if the goal is to get as many regular season games in as possible, I'm all for saving the integrity of the regular season. You know how much that means to me, Greeny. I hate when people dismiss the regular season. So if that's the case and the reason, I would expect each team that gets called upon, including a Steph Curry in Golden State, to actually go and participate. If the goal is just to go down there and kind of be a punching bag for the other teams that are getting ready for the postseason, and you're the Golden State Warriors, you've already won three championships, and to you, you won this year because you got yourself back in the lottery, you don't want to affect going into next season by now all of a sudden getting Steph Curry injured. So you don't want to put him out there. But if you're the Hawks and you have Trae Young, you actually do want him out there because it's something that he can build on, and your franchise doesn't have the history, the recent history of and success of the Golden State Warriors. So all situations aren't created equal.
So one way or another, Woj, all this is going to come down to a vote from the Board of Governors Thursday. Yes? What are we expecting here?
The Board of Governors are going to pass whatever the plan is that Adam Silver and the Players Association bring them. They have zeroed in on a 22-team format, likely the 16 teams that are in the playoff, you know, 1 through 8 in both conferences right now, and then 6 more teams, likely 5 in the Western Conference, 1 in the East, Washington. And still the details of what that's going to look like is going to be presented to the owners, what the structure and format is. But they're ready to get behind Adam Silver, approve a return to play, and head to Orlando sometime in July to move towards starting to play games there.
Sound good to you, Jalen? You good with this?
I'm very good with it, Greeny. And it's basically a version of what we discussed. And as I look deeper into some of these teams that may or may not be 7 or 8 seed or below, let me tell you some of the guys that play on those Western Conference teams. You notice Wolves said 4 from the West and 1 from the East. So Luka, Ja Morant, Dame Lillard, Zion Williamson, and then in the East, you may get John Wall back to play with Bradley Beal. That's some interesting big name talent that the NBA can put on display once they get back to playing basketball.
And if everyone will just excuse me, indulge me one moment of personal discussion with my friend, Mr. Rose. If the Pelicans make it to the playoffs, Jalen, you know you owe me that suit. I don't. Well, the circumstances are the circumstances. This goes in my favor.
That's crazy. They're going to get in as a 22nd team, and I'm going to lose my bet.
Listen, I mean, if I was any kind of man, I'd let you out of it, but there's no conceivable chance I'm going to. So we will see. Again, we're working our way towards this vote on Thursday. Guys, thank you very much. We'll check in with you later, of course. J&J, Jalen and Jacoby today, 4 o'clock Eastern time on ESPN. Now to baseball. Major League Baseball discussing the possibility of shortening the season to around 50 games and paying players their full prorated salary. Sources say the league views this plan as a last resort and does not intend to propose it to the players. I want to bring Mark Teixeira into this conversation here. We had Jeff Passan on about a half hour ago. I don't know if you got to hear that. Essentially, it feels as though the players are digging in on one side. The owners are digging in on the other side. What do you like about this plan, or what do you think of this plan the owners are throwing out here for far, far fewer games?
Well, I don't like the plan, Greeny, but you know, I think 80 games or 100 games is probably, you know, more respectable of a regular season. And I think the fans won more games. But the issue here is the owners are backed into a corner right now. And they're basically saying, all right, players, you're sticking on this prorated salary issue, which is understandable, okay? You want to get a full day's pay for a full day's work. The problem is I can't play 100 games and pay you full salary. So 50 might be my only option.
And so where does that leave everybody? I mean, if you were to be able to come in here and try and solve this and maybe save this, Buster Olney told us yesterday he thinks that the short-term future of the sport may hang in the balance over the next week to 10 days. How would you go about saving it?
Well, I think both sides need to understand that they have to invest in the future of their sport. And what I mean by that, when you invest, you take money out of your pocket, you usually give it to somebody else, but you hope that later on down the road, you're going to make that money back two or three times. So I think the players and the owners need to realize they're going to invest in each other, invest in the sport, lose a little bit of money now, but save baseball for this year and the future.
Okay, and so how does that look? There's never been a partnership. The distrust, mistrust between the two sides is legendary. They have partnerships of some sort in basketball, in football, in hockey. They don't have that in baseball. So is that something that you see coming from this?
I think, Greeny, this would have been the year for Major League Baseball and the players to understand that it is a partnership. And when bad things happen, when you have a global pandemic or a tragedy, business partners come together and they figure it out. This is not a good situation for anybody. Not for the players, not for the owners, not for the 30 million people that are out of a job right now in this country. But if you realize that it is a partnership, just like the NBA and the NHL, they look like they've come to some sort of agreement to move forward, then I think the players and the owners will understand that the fans are the ultimate beneficiaries of that partnership.
And one final question for you, just because it's a lot more fun than talking about money and talking about the two sides arguing and all of that. If they play some shortened season, 50 games, even 82 games, and someone hits 400, does that count? Like every baseball fan can tell you Ted Williams is the last guy to hit 400. He hit 406. He played in that doubleheader. These are legendary stories. Will you as a baseball player count that?
I wouldn't count it. I have one of my best friends in college went 6-for-9 in his college career, and he said he's the all-time hits leader, you know, or the batting average leader at Georgia Tech. At a certain point in time, you have to understand the history of baseball, and those stats are sacred, so you need to play well over 100 games for it to count for me.
Okay, so what's the number? Give me what's the Mendoza line or the Teixeira line on this? How many games do they have to play for that to be legit?
100 games. And I would love to see 100 games, and fans would love to see 100 games because we want more baseball.
Okay. If they play 100 games and someone hits 400, we're going to count it. Tex, thanks a million, my man. Great to see you as always. Meanwhile, we continue here with 100 days to go until the NFL season kicks off. And I've got predictions for you. Who wins MVP? Who wins the Super Bowl? I'll tell you all next. Get up, ESPN.